Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
I mean, it's drag for straight men.
It is drag for straight men.
And they would do reveals. Like, they would come out in their little robes and, like, take it, like, lights. It was a drag show.
Welcome back to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, the podcast that asks, whose fault is it that you're gay? This week we've got Brandon Kyle Goodman. You know them from Big Mouth. You know them as the winner of the Gay Ass Live Show, champion of character actress knowledge. And they're here to give an unbelievable conversation. I want to wish you all an official happy Pride, and I'm already really tired. WeHo Pride was this past weekend, and against my better judgment, I was in WeHo all 3 days of the weekend, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night. But honestly, despite the exhaust, it was pretty incredible. I got to see Idina Menzel perform. She sang from Rent. I saw Carly Rae Jepsen solidify herself as a mother. I also saw Lance Bass. I ordered a pizza next to Cody Rigsby. And I saw Twinks trip in their own vomit. Love is love. Tonight, I'm performing in Corpus Christi's Pride, and everyone's been so nice. I'm so touched that I was asked, and I don't know, I was excited before I got here, but now that I'm actually here, it's kind of hitting me that this would not have happened 2 years ago. Like, this is all so new and exciting, and I felt so amazing celebrating Pride with so many queer weirdos in LA, and now to do it in Texas, and to really bring the faggotrine station. Makes me just so excited. So I'm hoping that tonight goes great. And pray for me. We're going to get into this conversation with Brandon Kyle Goodman. At the end of the ep, we have an amazing conversation about which Real Housewife will be the first to win an Oscar. So please stick around for that. And if you disagree, blow us up in the DMs. Speaking of, thank you for all the messages about the podcast and the show. We've got some really nice reviews lately. So if you want to add a 5-star review, do that on Apple Podcasts or click on Spotify, the 5 stars, and that'll help us continue to grow the Gay Ass Golf Ball. Also, the tickets are going fast for the Gay Ass Live Show in LA on June 15th and New York on June 29th. So get those in the description. Happy Pride. I love you. You love me. We are one big faggotrini. Ladies, and gentlethems, may I announce the messy Monday matriarch, the famed actor, writer, star, and gay ass live show champion. This, my friends, is Brandon Kyle Motherfucking Goodman. Thanks for coming on. That's a Gay Ass Podcast, Brandon.
Yay. I'm so excited to be here. What an introduction. The mother, the matriarch, the messy matriarch.
Truly. Into it. The messy matriarch, who also is a cock, a champion of character actress knowledge from That's a Gay Ass Live Show. It's an honor to have you in your year of the reign. What's been the biggest difference in your life ever since you won the Gay Ass Golden Dildo at That's a Gay Ass Live Show?
I mean, I just feel better than everybody. Yeah. I walk into gay bars and I'm just really quite superior. You know, I look down on people.
And that's the goal.
It's been different. Yeah, yeah. I know my worth and I know who's inferior, and it's everybody except for me.
Well, I have to say that the show as a whole was so fun, but your Cheryl Lee Ralph lip sync was like genre defining for the show. And I haven't told you this yet, but as we book the next shows, I only send your lip sync out as an example of what to do. So
God, thank you. I was really excited. My husband like heard me rehearsing over the week for it, and he was like, "That's your favorite monologue." I was like, I know, and I had the opportunity to lip sync it, and I'm gonna fucking do it.
And she put the work in, and you did.
I put the work in, honey.
Did you is Cheryl Lee Ralph and like Sister Act 2, for anyone who wasn't at the show or hasn't listened yet, it's you did the scene with Lauryn Hill where singing does not put food on the table.
Yes.
Singing, it was that a scene that struck you the first time you saw the movie? Or like, why did you know you were going to lip sync that at the show?
I think so. I mean, that scene has always been iconic to me. I mean, that movie is iconic to me. It's like, what's your favorite film? And when you're a writer, I think we want you to say, like, I don't know, The Godfather, yeah, or whatever, Gone with the Wind, whatever the iconics are. And I'm like, Sister Act 2, babe. I think it was that thing of like, you have a dream, you have a goal. And sometimes it's the people closest to you who are your biggest obstacle. And how do you achieve that? And how do you defy them? And I think that that movie shows Lauren defying her mother and really following her heart, which I would say now in retrospect, I think also relates to queerness.
Yeah.
You know, like wanting to be yourself and your parent or your family being like, no, you can't do that, and doing it anyway. So,
okay. I'm not joking that I talk about that movie probably every week on this podcast and in my
yes.
life. And I don't think I've actually paid enough attention to the queerness of and like why I loved it so much, because for me as well, it is my number one all time favorite film. And it is one of the first times as a literal 11, 12 year old that I felt understood. And I think that that scene yes. is a big reason. And like, I think as queer people also want to protect our family and people. And so I feel the need right now to say, of course, my family is amazing because they are. But do I talk about in therapy about how I still have this feeling of danger when I want to express myself fully? I do. And so I think that that scene is a great example of, while of course our parents or families or close friends are trying to protect us, it actually subconsciously told us messages that were like, don't be yourself.
Yes, 1,000%. And, you know, what a beautiful thing to see Lauren do what she wants to do and win. And I think the lesson being, you know, sometimes your parents don't know. You know, sometimes the people in your life who are closest to you, who you love and respect, don't always know what's right and best for you. You ultimately have to make that decision and have to make that choice.
100%. And I think there's always a moment in a young person's life when they realize their parents aren't right all the time. I don't remember exactly where I was, but I remember almost the exact age I was. I think it was probably 8th or 9th grade. And I had like a That's a Raven eyeball moment where I was like, my parents aren't always right. It fucked with my head for a minute because they themselves told me that they were. And that
yes.
But then when you're like, wait, we're all flawed. And by the way, when my mom would tell me some of the drama she was having with her, like people around her, I said to her point blank as like a bitchy, queeny 14-year-old, I was like, so you agree, high school never ends. And she was like, yeah. I mean, some of the adult problems I hear around me even today or with my parents, I'm like, what is this, sophomore year?
It's so funny. So Big Mouth, we will talk to high schoolers to just, you know, make sure that we're staying on the pulse of what the fuck is actually happening in puberty these days.
Yeah.
And one of them said, it like blew our minds. We like wouldn't stop talking about. One of them said, we're just mocking what you do in the adult world. Like high school, we're just doing what you do. And it was like, oh my God.
Read me.
Like, you know, drag me. Girl, drag me down.
Well, seriously, that's like the devastation, I think, of human nature is that the emotional, I would say, peak of the majority of the world, it probably does not go beyond our teen years. And of course, there are people, and I do consider us both those people, who have the self-awareness of flaws and then kind of are able to lean into it and then, of course, learn from, which is why I want to get into Messy Mondays, because there's a few things you've brought up that is just absolutely gorgine. So for anyone who doesn't follow Brandon, which now you do and should and must, the Messy Mondays, you basically put like, let me hear the mess going on, and then people write in and then you
tell
share it on
good
your,
or messy.
Oh yeah, God, on your Instagram story. So there's I've written down a few of my faves. We'll start with some of the scandals and the sexy ones, and then I'll get into some of my deeper questions too. Recently someone referenced a 4G, which I was also the first time I had heard of the term 4G, which of course is just a 2-on-2 situation. But you said that it's great because everyone gets equal dick and ass, which I find to be such a beautiful poetic statement. Would you have a preference between threesomes or 4Gs?
You know what? I'd probably choose, I mean, listen, a 4G could also end up where it's 3-on-1 or whatever, but I would probably choose a 4G because sometimes the threesome dynamic, unless all three of you equally are attracted to each other mm-hmm. and want each other and have like kind of discussed that ahead of time, can be tricky. I've been in some threesomes where I've been the third and it's like one partner really wanted to be with me and the other partner is like nervous or like yeah. isn't as into it or whatever it is, and it's just like a weird vibe. Whereas I think if there are four of us, I feel like there's less likely for that to happen. Of course anything can happen, but yeah, I'm probably a preferred 4G.
I think that makes a lot of sense because I feel like there's been a lot of sketch comedy about like the third person who's just trying to get in the middle of the two who are into each other.
Yes. And yes,
I have definitely, I think, been in all three different positions of that threesome situation.
Yeah, where you're like into one, not as much as the other. You're both. So I always say now, especially if it's a couple, you know, I think it's easier when it's like three of you
individ.
Who are not attached. Yes, individ. Oh my God, I love your the way you speak. It's perfect. it's so gay. But the when it's like a couple, you know, I really do think you have to like do your homework and make sure that everyone is truly on the same page about what's going on.
I like that you say that. When you say when you're in a threesome, you are hyper aware because
yes.
That, and I think if anyone, like, let me just be so transparent. As I say that, I'm like, how transparent should I be? let me be so transparent and give you a half of a sentence. I will say that I have not had much of a more than one another and the other person experience until mm-hmm. recently. And I do think that there is a learning curve with that dynamic. And it's very apparent when a person is hyper aware of the inclusivity of
yes.
the holes and the poles and the walls and the bowls.
Come on.
So I thank you for your cervix.
Yes, I try to be more aware now when I'm in those situations. But a friend of mine gave me a tip, and this was like she and her partner were dating somebody, but they did a thing where they all put themselves in the same group chat. So you weren't actually having an individual off. It was like you all three were in the same group thread and could like, you know, get the sexy foreplay going that way. And I thought it was a really smart and healthy way to just like make sure that everyone, you know, feels included.
Yeah, I love that. And it's also almost like a subconscious thing where even just the decision to do the three-way chat makes it not something you actively say, but just the action of doing that.
Yes.
Gives a sign to everyone that it's like, we're all here.
Yes.
To absolutely. Get on and get that's off. Did you answer the question for yourself when someone said they were planning a gangbang for their 40th birthday? How many people make a gang?
Oh, yes. I said at least, I think it's 8 to 10 at least, but at least 8. Like that's a light gang. But I was like, you like 4 people, 5 people, 6 people, you could still fight them. That's not a gang. Like you need at least 8 to 10 for a gangbang. But I also made sure to specify that a gangbang is 10 against 1. You know what I'm saying? Like it's not like quite like it's a version of an orgy, but an orgy is usually we're all like moving through and whatever, but a gangbang is everybody against me.
Me, myself, and
I and my whole
me, and then the eye and then your whole winks like an eye blink. Okay, so then another person wrote in and they can get of course like deep and personal. They said they were breaking up after 10 years together and they were asking kind of how to untangle. My question for you, because obviously I think we can both agree that breakups are truly one of the worst things to go through.
Yeah,
what's your experience with like the longest relation that you had been in that was a breakup, and how did you get to the other side?
Oof. The longest relationship, well, I'm currently in my longest relationship.
Right.
My husband and I will be together for 8 years in a couple weeks, in a week or two. We can never agree on when our whatever anniversary is, but in the next week or two.
Well, mazel tov, an early mazel tov in the 8 years.
Thank you so much. But before that, it was about 2 years, and I lived with this person. I always say if you live with somebody, it feels a little longer.
Yes.
Because you're just in each other's orbit. And that was hard, but the biggest takeaway for me was my friends. I had done such a bad job letting my friends in on that relationship, especially when I was, you know, going through some dark times in it. And my godfather, I read about this in my book. My godfather was the one who called me out, because when I broken up with that partner, I went to my godfather and he was like, "Do your friends know about this?" And my godfather is a gay man, you know, was in New York during the 80s, lost a lot of friends. And so family and chosen family means something even more to him. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. That, like, we've now, like, adopted in our generation, but, like, really meant something to him. So he's like, "Where are your friends?" And I was like, "Oh, I don't want to, like, burden them with stuff." And I felt like me sharing this stuff was burdening them. And he was like, "But are they allowed to come to you when they have stuff?" And I was like, "Of course. Like, I love to help them." And he said to me very plainly, he was like, "Well, that's manipulative. Because you're," which I was like, "Baby, that's a tough word. That's a full word there. Let me look that up, baby." But he said, he was like, "It's manipulative because you're holding yourself as this, and basically in the space of perfection, right? It's not a two-way street. It's a one-way street. So somebody is sharing themselves with you, being vulnerable with you, but you're not doing the same back. And that's manipulative because it makes you seem like you're got your shit together all the time when you don't. And isn't that what friends are really for? Like, yes, let's kiki, let's throw back some shots, let's, you know, wipe our holes on the floor of a gay bar, but
of course, as always,
mm-hmm. also in those hard times, in those really difficult times, that's really when your friends are of necessity.
And it proves, I think, that you are both seeing each other in the difficulty, which makes them more human, and also reminds the person who's helping you that they don't need to be perfect too. Because let me tell you something, your godfather clearly is an icon, because that is so deep and well said. I have a friend who is lifelong friend, will be friends until the day I die. And I had a moment, I told her this years ago. We've been friends for like 25 years at this point.
Oh,
and she knows this, that I used to put her relationship on a pedestal because I was like, they always seem so great and my relationship is fucked. And because theirs is great and I realized as time went by, we were both just going through our own paths of how we deal with our relationship. I kind of came from the place, I think, of like dealing by complaining or whatever. And then the way that she dealt was probably of trying not to share as much about her its difficulties as a protection or whatever it was. But I think as the years went by, you know, they've been together for a very long time. I've been with Matt for a long time. And I think we both saw, and once I kind of said that, I felt insecure sometimes. We both realized how letting each other in on some of the difficulties, and of course, a respectful way to our partners, actually helped us realize how we were, of course, similar, and just the difficulties of relationships, period. But it helped our friendship even more, because one of us did not feel like the other one was perfection and we were all fucked up, which is what I was tending to do. So this makes a lot of sense to me.
And it also, I will say, if you are in a relationship, it also helps relationship, because even with Matthew, when we first started dating, I would say you can't actually bring everything to me. You actually need to go to your friends with some of that stuff, because when you bring some of the raw processing that has to do with your partner, you can't unsay certain things, right? Mm-hmm. But your best friend can take on the raw processing where you're like, "I hate that motherfucker." Like all that shit, right? All the things you want to say. And then your best friend goes, "All right, now let's like work through this," right? And there's no harm done to your partner, right? Whereas if you give all of that to your partner, right, you want to be honest and transparent with your partner, but you also want to be respectful and caring and loving in the way that you do it.
Yeah.
And so sometimes when you give that first draft to your partner about your partner, it can be really damaging.
Or even like giving the first draft of all of your needs, I think, of like, "I need this, I need this, I need this. And if you can't give it to me, then you're bad and we're bad." And honey, did I do that? Yes. Did I have to learn? I've learned, which, because my man is also named Matt, so we love the similar taste.
Look at us. That's weird.
He and I just really have different emotional lives in our physical form. Like, I give him so much credit and respect because he has such a groundedness and things can kind of roll off his back more. And I feel things so deeply. And of course, in all directions, the joy, the excitement, the laughter, but also the sensitivity, the pain, et cetera, is probably partly why I do the things I do, like, you know, talking through these types of things and all of that. But I learned through couples therapy this past year that just because I feel something so deeply and he doesn't mean that it's invalidating my feelings. It's just our literal physical experiences. And if I need to get something from someone else, that is okay. Yes. And it's a hard truth about relationships that I don't think are very communicated to the world at large when you're like watching movies and shit.
Yeah, because everything in a movie is fucking Cinderella. And you're like, girl, it takes a little more than that. And I will say for anyone, I always thought couples therapy was like for when you're in trouble. And we went to couples therapy when we were in trouble. Mm-hmm. But what I actually learned is like everyone should go to fucking couples therapy.
100%.
Just like you, especially if you like you didn't have, which most of us didn't have, like group watching functional, healthy marriages where people over communicated and like. Our parents' generation weren't doing that.
No, yeah.
And so we only have a certain number of tools. And so if we're trying to get past that to this like next level in our relationship, having some support is really, really necessary and invaluable.
I agree. And when I hear people in our parents' generation start to do the thing of like, you know, your generation does this and this poorly. I know every generation has their things. And I know that ours has ours. However, they have no leg to stand on when it comes to like emotional intelligence and health and communication. I'm like, some of the reactions, I'm like, y'all need Fran Goldfarb, the therapist I had for 7 years, and she will put you together.
Get you together.
Honey. So listen, I do have so many more questions about this because it is so interesting to me. But I do want to ask you first the famous gay ass podcast question, which is Brandon Kyle Goodman. Whose fault is it that you're gay? Who do we blame, babe?
Yeah, that's easy. Dwayne The Rock Johnson. That's who you will blame forever and ever. That man.
She said, that's easy.
That's easy.
So give me the entree to Dwayne The Rock. Was it the wrestling days or was it later?
It was. It was WWF before WWE, which I think it is now. It was WWF, which like really dates me. But yeah, I mean, like it was like middle school, the boys were really into wrestling. I was starting, you know, when we were in elementary school, I think like I was still a bit of an outcast. Like I think people could smell the queerness and didn't quite know what it was. You know, we weren't talking about gay or queer in third grade, but there was a femininity. And so there was a distance that I had with the boys. But then once we got into middle school, you really felt that separation between boys and girls.
Oh yeah.
And, like, immediately. It was like, it was rough. And then if you're the queer kid, especially a feminine queer kid, you really feel outed or ousted. But the boys were really into wrestling. And so I think in a way to like try and bond, I was like, all right, I'm going to watch wrestling. And so I used to religiously, I think it was Thursday nights, would watch the WWF. And that motherfucker, Dwayne The Rock fucking Johnson, walked out whenever he did in them fucking tight underwear, baby. Or what do they call speed? I don't know what the fuck they're called, but them and those boots, as to this day, like if you want to fuck with your shoes on, that's kind of hot.
You said like, put the Dwayne booties on and
yes, baby. And he lifted that one eyebrow, you know, if you smell what the rock is cooking, baby, my hole went. I want to smell it.
Your whole tried to smell.
Well, it's like, I can smell.
That's okay. It's so funny is I remember those days as well. Because I think we're very close in age. And I remember the boys loving the wrestling. And I wish I had the computer chip in my brain that enjoyed the actual competitive wrestling part of it, but I literally only cared about the pectoral muscles, the butts, and that was about it. But I have friends who are still super into wrestling today, and I do know there's a big queer following because it is camp, but The Rock, I feel like kind of combined all of that, the camp and the hot.
Yes, absolutely. I did love the story. I mean, I think you know, we're storytellers, so there was a part of me that loved the stories. I didn't really care about the actual, like, who won, but, like, you know, the fake drama.
Yeah. Well, that's like, what surprises me still to this day is how grown-ass men, and this is not a read, this is just a true, like, the fact that there's such a theatricality to that type of wrestling. That
high camp.
Let me be, like, help me out here. It is all pretty much planned, right?
Yeah,
that's all.
So as far as I know, it's like a scripted,
right? Like, so like the fact that there are people who are actively cheering on essentially a play of men wearing next to nothing, I love that there is a huge faction of straight men who can really lean into that. And
I mean, it's drag for straight men.
It is drag for straight men.
It's 1000%. I mean, Hulk Hogan came out in like boas. Like,
you remember, that's like, so true. Boas.
Like, it was a fucking drag, and they would do reveals. Like, they would come out in their little robes and like take it like lights. It was a drag show.
Well, and since we are in Pride Month, not to, you know, bring up the fuckery that's happening, but like, if they're gonna outlaw drag queens, then honey,
wrestlers.
Yeah, the wrestlers is essentially a drag eleganza.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Talk about whatever, never mind. It's just like,
and they had runways. Remember the runway? They had to walk the runway to get to the ring. Come on.
Boom, the cackity cat cat. And then you all of a sudden, I want to see one of those gigantic men do a death drop, honestly.
Yes.
Would love to see them try. So then you of course loved Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Did you come out while you were still in the middle high school age, or was it after you left?
No. It was after I left. I came out in college. So I came out my end of my sophomore year, or like the summer between my sophomore and junior year of college.
And I don't know if
I came out.
If we talked about this during the show, but you were at NYU, yes?
I was at NYU, yes.
I was there. I graduated 2012.
Okay, I was 2005 to 2009, so we might have had some crossover.
Yeah, we probably had 1 year crossover. You came out in sophomore year of college.
What was that like?
Was it something that you had felt stronger to do because you were surrounded by so many faggotrinis, or were you outed? Like, what happened?
It was not that. And I also talk about this where the faggotry was everywhere, but it was white. And so there still wasn't a safety inside of being black and queer. Like, it still was like, oh, here are all the gays, but they are white. And at that time, and I don't, you know, probably maybe still now, but there was an expectation of performance. I really felt like, you know, what they wanted blackness to look like, and especially black queerness to look like. Mm-hmm. I mean, the obsession, listen, as you should be, with black women is massive, and you should be, but it was to me, a very performative space. As opposed to a genuine like interest in culture and in your experience and in your life, like what are the ups and the downs? I think I actually imagine a lot of black students would argue that there's a feeling of needing to be the entertainment always, you know, like needing to come in and be joyful and
play a role,
the jokes. Play the role. That's when you're accepted and brought in. So I didn't feel safe right in a way to come out. I think I had to navigate my blackness inside of it, because as T.S. Madison so beautifully puts, you know, I'm not black and then queer. I'm black and queer at the same damn time. You know, it's like those things are not, you can't pull them apart. Mm. So I think I had to reckon with my blackness first, and loving that identity, and then could kind of allow space for me to understand my queerness. At that time, just the gayness, because now I also identify as non-binary, which I didn't realize that was also playing a part in the turmoil during that time.
Did you feel when you had come out sophomore year, was the white gays around you, the program that you were in, like, did you feel that there was a genuine support, or did you feel that there was like a box that they were trying to put you in, or what was that experience like?
I feel like there was from my friends. Yes. I think people knew. I think like I wasn't, you know, she was like, cat, hey, what's that? You know, like I think the girls, everyone was like, oh yeah, you're homosexual, but you're not out yet.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Except for one evil gay who did try to out me, immediately. I was like, you're gay. Let me double back. I don't think we were 18 years old. So I want to put that in context. We were 18, we're kids. We don't always know
exactly how to approach things. Yeah.
What a weird fucking time. So I think that they just like screamed out that you're gay in like a, he was very confident white boy in his gayness. And I think, wanted everyone to be out, you know, like wasn't really caring about what the process was. So I don't think he meant it maliciously, but it was harmful at the time. But I think once I came out, cause my freshman year, my roommate, I was lucky to have a roommate who is bisexual. And he was kind of like, hey, just like, you don't have to tell anybody anything. Just like, go ahead, explore. And if, you know, by the end of the year, you feel one way more than the other, then go ahead. They say gay, bi, AMA. Then feel free to come out. And so I did do that exploration. And then I ended up getting a boyfriend, I think the summer of my sophomore year or something like that. And he was also cool with me staying in the closet until I was comfortable, which was really helpful. And it's funny, it's not something that I think I would have had the space to do for someone else, but really grateful that someone could hold me in that way. And then once I was comfortable, I did start telling people. Definitely told my, like, my best friend at the time while I was drunk, you know, needed to be, you know, under the influence. But everyone was really supportive and, like, held me, and nothing changed. It was just kind of like, great. I think it was kind of like, finally, it's been fucking 2 years, baby.
Well, that's, I think, a really great nuance of a lot of times it's just like, and then it came out and then I was out, versus, like, I think what you're describing really makes sense, which is that there's that nuance of coming out in parts to people and to yourself. And I think, like, having a boyfriend who on your terms was cool with you coming out when you were to come out is, like, such a beautiful thing. And there's that like shitty thing that some people still, I'm sure, say a lot to this day when someone comes out, which is like, well, of course I knew the whole time, or like, it felt icky to me when I came out and I told a friend that, and they were like, honey, we already knew. And it's like, I understand that you're trying to already kiki and be silly, but I'm still very much in the, like, trying to feel safe and okay and proud of myself, and you saying that we all knew before you did doesn't make me feel proud. It makes me feel dumb. And I don't want to feel dumb about coming out as the literal gay fucking person I am. So, like, there's so much so much nuance. And the fact that you bring up that we were 18 years old when we went to college, and that alone, you're a child. I mean, that's a child.
Yes, you are. You're still, you know, and if an 18-year-old hears this, you're like, I'm not a child. But, like, when you look back, it's like, it's still, you're still needing to be nurtured and held, and you are, you're still developing. There's still, you're a child still. It's, you're figuring it out. We just push our 18-year-olds out there and say, figure it the fuck out. But it's like, you've had no preparation to figure out how to build your community, how to build safe spaces, how to always identify who's for you, who's not for you. You're still learning all that stuff. And to add, coming out is so raw that, yes, the only appropriate response is, thank you so much for sharing that with me. Yes, and I love you, and I'm here for you.
That is it.
As opposed to, girl, I knew.
What's your drag name? You're like, bitch.
Bitch, what?
Well, I have a memory talking about this age of discovery. I was just turned 19, freshman year of college, and I had come out a few months prior, right before I went to New York for college, and I had never kissed a boy, had never had any boy experience. I have my first boy kiss days after my 19th birthday. It's the end of September. I was so head over heels with, I was just like, he's cute. We kissed. It was magical. And he wants to hang out in a few days. I was like,
oh my God,
that high. Girl flying high. Yeah. Called my friend from the walk home from the first kiss. It was, of course, in U-Haul, right by Union Square.
Yes, come on,
and University I then was supposed to hang out with him a few days later. And he texts me, hey, can we talk or something? And I was like, okay. And he says to me, I actually can't go on a date with you. I don't want to date anyone right now. It's too early for me. And I, of course, now as a, you know, 33-year-old man can be like, well, duh, you were an 18-year-old freshman in college, like 3 weeks in. That was the right move. But to me, I was devastated. And devastated. I said this, and I know a lot of people feel this way, but I was fully in the kindergarten development stage of dating. Yeah.
1000%. That's the thing with when you're queer is, like, your classmates are figuring it out at, like, fourth grade.
Yeah. You
know, like, they're figuring it out in high school. They're going through the motions of what dating is and da-da-da. And as queer folks, you don't really get to explore that until you're around more queer people, one, and until it's safe to explore it. And that might not happen until you're 18, 19, 20, 23, you know. And so you're in that kindergarten stage or in that beginning stage, even though you yourself are older. And so it also feels so fucked up because you feel like you're behind.
Yes. And then you have to grow up really fast. That's what's fucked up too about just being a queer person going to college, but especially like going, like studying theater and all that. It's like, you not only have to grow up as an adult coming to terms with being queer, but then you also have to like learn how to move through an industry that is super fucked up. And then you have to learn like what you are into sexually. Yes. And then you have to learn what you're into emotionally. And then you have to learn how dating works. I mean, it is a miracle that we are the icons we are today, because
Come on, girl. It's a lot.
It's a lot.
You have to find your pride. It's the thing I say. It's like there's a difference between coming out and being proud. Mm. You know what I'm saying? And so like you can come out of the closet, but it doesn't mean that you have a grapple on what it means now.
Yeah.
And so it takes some time to build all of that out and find that space where you can finally say, oh my goodness, I love who I am and I love who I'm about and I stand tall in my queerness.
Okay.
Proudly.
That brings up a question that I admire about you is that you're not only like all of the things I admire in a performer person, which is like intelligence, emotional intelligence, hilarity, beauty, all of it, but you also have like a shamelessness about the fucking, about what turns you on, about what is relatable about sexuality. When did you feel like a strong enough person to be able to put that energy out into the world?
You know, I think working on Big Mouth was a big part of that. Mm. Because, you know, we're spending every day talking about sexuality and talking about those awkward things and our awkward moments. And watching, you know, before I was on the show, before I wrote on the show, voiced on the show, I watched it because a friend, it was an assistant on a on Modern Love. It was a PA who was like, I think you would like Big Mouth. And I was like, okay, girl. So I like watched it. And I remember watching, I think it was like the first or second episode, which is like, Are You Gay? And Andrew, actually, Andrew watches a trailer of The Rock. Now that I'm thinking about it, watches the trailer of it, starring a movie with The Rock. Yes. And he thinks he might be gay. And the whole episode is him going through that and his hormone monster, Maury, who is just toxic masculinity in a good way, was so cool with it and was like, let's figure it out. And seeing that dynamic of this like really butch, like masculine character take this boy on this journey to figure out if he was gay, and then coming to the conclusion that he wasn't, and that his friend Nick was kind of like, I don't, like, if you are, that's great. If you're not, like, I think Nick actually kissed him to be like, did you feel anything? Mm-hmm. That was so healing. And all of the shame kind of dissipated in watching that. And then the show itself, I think, does that because we don't realize how traumatic puberty is because we never revisit it.
Yeah.
And I think the show allows you to revisit this really awful time and realize that you weren't alone, that everyone was fucking navigating it, and kind of heal those traumas. And once I was kind of immersed in that world, it made me want to do that for other people in other ways.
Yes. I mean, it's healing to me when I see it because I come from a place as well of you're not supposed to share certain things or be too much. And I think that when I see it come from a person like you who has a wisdom about it and of course doesn't take themselves too seriously, but also is super frank, it like it's the example that I want to see more and more of, and of course aspire to do for myself with this podcast and with everything, is like the taking away of the shame and then leaving the honesty. And then also, like, for example, when we did the live show and you brought up a trick about when someone is beating your pussy and you said that the best way to get them to go even harder is to go, is that all you got? And that to me was like minute 6 of the show when you all the panel came on, and then it immediately opened the floodgates for the other panelists to also talk about their honesty. And you gave a gift, and I just listened to it because they released it as an episode, but I remember saying, like, give a round of applause to the sluts on stage, and I remember the audience roaring because we were, I think there was like a fuck yeah, we're at a gay fucking show.
Yes.
And like, by the way, my parents were there and I'm thrilled that they got to get a window into that world. But like, there was so much shame that I was told. And also, like, Matt and I, again, have such a difference of perspective, but he really, you know, he went to Catholic school growing up. He grew up queer in Georgia, and there's like such an idea of, you know, not oversharing. And I think that he has done such an amazing job of being proud of who he is, but we still bump heads at times of like, if he thinks I'm doing too much. And it's a constant conversation that not easy, but it's just, I think, a part of being who we are and what's going on right now.
Well, you're reckoning. I went to boarding high school in Georgia, so being queer in Georgia was rough. But, you know, I think you're reckoning with what you've been indoctrinated with for all these years. And then if you think about the years that you've, like, been told you're too much or this is wrong, mm-hmm. but it's like from birth until what? Like, for me, I would say 27, 28 mm-hmm. was when I started to question things. So most of, and like really like being confident in it is like the last 3 or 4 years. So I have like 4 years of confidence in this up against the rest of my life. So it's going to be a constant battle because you're just, those things are like in our DNA. And I also want to say that you do all those things in your show. I loved being at that live show. And I think I said this to you, it was like just unapologetic queerness and gayness in a way that I don't think we always see and value. It's like we're told that if you're that flamboyant, you're like this, or you talk about that, that you're not a good person or some shit.
Yeah.
And to just like be in this space and like it opens with like you singing a song with like two hot boys that are shirtless and they're short shorts. And then suddenly we're talking about, you know, when somebody's beating your pussy, like whatever it is, it's like, yeah, this is, we're all good people. We're all great people. We're also joyous and fun and free.
Yes.
And there's a value in that.
Damn. So that means a lot. And I think that what you have described about that feeling of confidence and pride in the past few years is I'm very much towards the beginning of that journey, and that show is my rebellion and celebration of it. And and I think that what you referenced about like being flamboyant was always so bad. I don't know if this ever happened to you, but especially when you're like, you know, learning to be an actor and you're trying to be a performer, I remember there was a big praise when gay people, like a gay man, could pass as straight when they were performing. And it was and I remember, and I had people in my life tell me like, yeah, but you can still play straight, right? And I'd be like, of course.
That was the highest honor.
The highest honor was, like, can you play straight? And then I started to audition after college and realize that like me trying to play the love interest in Much Ado About Nothing ain't gonna be the ticket for me. And I realized as I was auditioning for more like TV and commercial stuff, if I got cast as the office gay, I loved it because I was like, you know what? I'm gonna lean in and be proud of it. But I remember people in my life being like, well, aren't you like upset that it's not the only thing you can play? And I was like, I know it's not the only thing I can play, but why do you think I should be ashamed of playing it?
Exactly.
What about that question? Do you think it's a bad thing that I'm presenting as gay for a lot of people to see? You maybe don't think that actively, but subconsciously that question is telling me that you don't want me to be gay on a platform.
And that's actually the wrong question, too. It's like, well, why don't they write the part better?
Hello?
You know what I'm saying? Like, why don't they write better parts for queer characters, right? It's like, yeah, you're like, are you afraid about being the office gay? Yeah, because you're afraid of being pigeonholed. And it's like, yeah, but let's talk about how they write that office gay. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm always going to come in for the punchline. And I'm always going to be the gay best friend. Like, hey, girl, his dick is too big. You should leave him. And then you like twirl away. And it's like, yeah, that's the problem.
Right.
Like, I'm an actor. You're an actor. We went to school. We studied this. Mm-hmm. I can act circles around my straight colleagues. But I'm not given the opportunities unless I need to play a straight character. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, okay, write a better queer character, right? So like write a fuller, more realized three-dimensional character instead of just, and I feel this as a black person too, oftentimes you're brought in to be like, hey, what's up, girl? Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, I can do that, but like I'm also, that person is still three-dimensional. Where is their story?
Exactly.
I always say, like, I want to see the story where, like, you know, the camera is on that lead white girl and it just, like, shifts to that black queer friend and stays with the black queer friend. Are they still as funny? Are they still as, you know, joyous all the time? Like, would you see them in their sadness? Like, where is their humanity?
Yes. Well, I think that, you know? That it's almost like you're manifesting the wish for Natasha Rothwell's character for the next White Lotus season, because I think that it was such an interesting take on Jennifer Coolidge in the first season of White Lotus, was kind of treating Natasha as the side character that did not have a full dimension. But then we did get at least the ability to see Natasha's reaction to being fucked over or strung along. And so the fact that they're bringing her back, I like what you describe. God, I can't fucking wait. And I think that I look forward to the day where you or someone makes that project of the panning over and getting the fuller look into not only the funny black friend that they have written, but also for just the side characters that are only supposed to function as a plot device.
Yes. Yes, which you feel that whether it's a race thing or an ethnicity thing or it's a queer thing, these characters are often just pawns for the straight cis protagonist.
Right.
And it's like there's enough of those stories and we have full stories as well.
Well, a hilarious segue then would be to ask you a question that is actually talking about these female character actress parts. I need to ask you the next podcast question, because we respect these women and we need these women. If the world was ending and you could only save one character actress, who would you save?
There's so many good answers here. I just saw The Little Mermaid yesterday.
Oh my God, I just saw it as well.
And so like I was fully ready to like save Melissa McCarthy because she is playing Ursula Down, give her an Oscar. I'm going to save Kim Fields, who plays Regine on Living Single. Erica Alexander's a close second on that show, but like the Living Single, Kim Fields and Erica Alexander are master classes on that show. Kim Fields plays Regine, who is like this bougie character who really has no money and is always looking for a man. And she started doing this thing where like she would just like start changing her wigs. And I think one of the first characters to like be like, I'm wearing a wig. Like it's a, you know, now today we're like, it's a wig. But back in the 90s, like you weren't supposed to like, talk about it.
Yeah.
And Regine was always switching her wigs out and was always reading somebody down and was always just like making the best faces and the best one-liners. And it's a double save. Erica Alexander, I remember reading an interview where they said she didn't have as many lines in the beginning, so she just started eating. So she was just in the scenes eating. And that became her character trait, was that like Max would come to the house, Queen Latifah's house, and just like raid the fridge and was all like every scene always just eating. And I was like, that is brilliant, underrated character.
We love a bit. We love a bitsy bitsy spider. And by the way, when you said Kim Fields, I knew that she has had quite a long career. And in fact, I've looked up, she was first on TV at the age of 7 years old.
However, Facts of Life?
Yeah.
Is that her first
show? So she did Facts of Life. And then she did, and I thought I was being crazy when I thought this, but she did do one season of The Real Housewives of Atlanta. In 2015 as a full-time peach holder and left after one season. And I thought I made that up, but she definitely did.
She definitely did. I don't know why she did. I feel like she probably thought it could be a good career revamp. Cause you know, I think the housewives come in and they like are able to like really build something off of it, but she's an actress. You know what I'm saying? I think Kenya's going to want to like fuck with you, which Kenya did. And it's like, Kim is like, I'm an actress. I'm for real.
It takes a very specific type of actor to want to be a cast member on The Real Housewives. Like the fact that Lisa Rinna, it worked so well for her is because she is an actor, but she's also a monster. The monstrous feeling I mean is more of like is a master at holding attention. And Kim Fields, I think, is an actor that tells stories that speak to her, whereas Lisa Rinna, of course, is a storyteller, but she also has a different idea of the different media that you need to tell that story on. And so Lisa Rinna knew she was still telling stories on The Real Housewives, but honey, she did not mind that she was dragging her entire family and her own self into it in that way.
It was like one clearly wants, which, you know, I'm not going to put a judgment on it, but one clearly wants, you know, attention and I don't mean that in a bad way, but like is down for the attention and to make the check, right? I'll do what I need to do.
She will sell the diapers. She will.
Absolutely. She's like, I'll do what I need to do to clear the check. And that's very clear. Whereas I felt like Kim was like, I'm still an actress, a performer, like, mm-hmm. and I'm really fucking good. And I don't know if I can, you know, come for these girls the way I want to, because I still want to have this, you know, I still want to do my work. And I think there's a piece of you that gives that up in a way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know? I would be very, very interested to see an actor who becomes a Real Housewife and then
wins an Oscar
after. like here's the deal. Fantasia Barrino will hopefully win the Oscar for The Color Purple movie. Idol to Oscar winner, we can see as possible Jennifer Hudson and Fantasia. Absolutely. However, Real Housewife to Oscar winner, that's
a different vibe, baby.
Honey, I don't different... know. I mean, if you had to name, this is a very tough question, we can both brainstorm. Yeah. If you were to name one person who has been, is currently, or has been a Real Housewife that is the most likely to win an Oscar, who do you think it would be?
Oh my God.
I'm going to just spitball and say,
go ahead.
There's, I think that Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, Eileen Davidson, she's like so plain that, like, okay. I know she's a good actor. I can just tell.
Yes.
That to me is a person who maintained her dignity and would still be able to be cast in maybe an Oscar vehicle in a moment if the stars aligned.
Yeah, I know. I would agree with you on that, because there's something about, like, she always kind of held herself in a certain, like,
yes,
I'm an actor.
Yeah. Like, but like, are there any, I mean,
that could get an Oscar?
The biggest gag would be if Kim Richards somehow
pulled that
a
off.
A biopic, really. Yeah, but besides that, I can't think of...
I don't know. I mean, I would root for them. Like, I'd root for Marlo Hampton to get an Oscar.
Can you imagine?
I'd root for him. I don't know if that would... I think Candy has it the right way. It's like, Candy's like, I'm going to get my EGOT, but I'm not necessarily... I don't need to, like, be in front of the camera for it. I can be a producer.
Well, yeah, Candy is clearly a genius in the industry. Like...
Oh, absolutely.
The fact that she's had how many shows on Bravo now, and even if one gets canceled, she just says, next.
Next one. I think we will study her in a couple of years, because she's really managed to take her legitimate career and take this thing that, you know, for a little bit was just kind of like the Housewives, and now it's, you know, the fucking Housewives, and really build businesses like a fucking franchise,
a true dynasty. I don't know what the net worth is, but I know that.
But you know she's fine, and the kids are going to be fine, and the grandkids are going to be
fine. That is generational. Like, that is generational.
That's generational. She's working on that for sure.
I can't wait for her to create at least one generation's worth.
Same, baby. Same.
Well, listen, I need to ask you the final podcast question, which is, Brandon Kyle Goodman, we might already have the answer because it's been discussed, but I did not prep you on this. What is the best Whoopi Goldberg film?
Yeah, we're going to just go ahead and say Sister Act 2.
Can I just say, I saw Into Your Mind while the wheels were turning? I saw you go...
I did. I was going through my Rolodex, and I was like, I'm just going to have to land here at Sister Act 2. There are so many.
You connected, and you committed to your gut. You trusted your gut, and that's what we have to learn as people. And you, I think, honey, have learned that lesson, and I thank you for saying the right answer to you and to me. And Brandon, before we sign off, thank you for coming on. But where first can people follow you?
Oh my goodness. The main place is Instagram at Brandon Kyle Goodman. And that will take you to all the other places that I exist. But yeah, Brandon Kyle Goodman.
Bless this queer, beautiful mess. Thank you for coming on. That's a Gay Ass Podcast. And I will see you at the next one.
Please.
As always, thanks for listening to That's a Gay Ass Podcast. I hope you're taking care of yourself this Pride, and despite the devastation of the world, you're a fucking badass bitch. Don't forget it. Get your tickets to the live show. Leave the 5-star review. I'm done lecturing you, my children. I'll see you next week.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.